Happy Monday. It's Keith Tomasek, and you're listening to The Inadequate Life, a podcast about the creative process and the people whose lives depend upon it. On today's show, J. Kelly Nestruck, journalist and critic with the Globe and Mail, Canada's top national newspaper. Kelly's a well-read, thoughtful critic. Often, his writing inspires me to connect on a deeper level with the artist whose work he's reviewing. I first started noticing Kelly's work not in the paper, but online. Kelly's love of theater began in Winnipeg and Montreal, where he studied at McGill and dabbled as an actor and writer at the Fringe Festival. Kelly and I had a great chat about Montreal, Stratford, Toronto, social media, and more. That's coming up in The Inadequate Life. I have to tell you, this is the second person who basically had to do the podcast while they were eating breakfast, even though it was 2 p.m. And, you know, that happens when you're in theater. You're staying up late and you're getting up late. I remember back in the day when I was performing once, staying up, you know, you stay up till 4 a.m., 5 a.m. And part of that was, well, you know, if we just stay up another hour, we can probably get the morning edition of the paper. And you do that. And then you get the paper, pass out, and get up 2, 3 p.m. Of course, Kelly wasn't waiting for the paper. He was creating the words that go in it, staying up in his hotel room all by himself in the dark, typing away one of his reviews. We met at Karen Hartwick's shop, Tea Leaves, and hopefully you listen to the show and you know that Karen Hartwick is a sponsor of The Inadequate Life, and I'm so grateful for her to doing that. And it was so kind of her. She kind of surprised us when we got there. I was just expecting to go and borrow her space for the interview in a quiet room she has, but she surprised us with this really special dark oolong tea from Hunan Province. And I say she surprised us with the tea because we weren't really expecting anything. We just went there for the room, and she did this entire tea tasting ritual, and it was quite sensual, really sensual. And the ritual around this very rare dark oolong includes a fragrance cup. It's a little cup that you use to catch the fragrances while the tea is brewing. It's quite special. And before you taste the tea, you smell the fragrance from the fragrance cup. And as you smell the fragrance changes. And, you know, the fragrance cup is about the circumference of a champagne flute. And that made me think about champagne. And I compared the experience to this amazing champagne I had a few years ago. It was a Bollinger Grand Année. And that's a champagne Bollinger only produces during exceptional harvests. And let me tell you, the champagne and the fragrance from Karen's tea was definitely exceptional. Pretty amazing experience, you know, just smelling, just like a champagne. It sort of, it changes and evolves as you breathe and just experience it. Karen is a tea sommelier, a certified tea sommelier. So if you like tea as much as I do, just go online, check out StratfordTeaLeaves.com. Or even better, if you're near Stratford, visit the shop next time you're there and tell her Keith sent you, right? I'm just going to have a cup of tea right now, actually. Hang on. There you go. Hey, Susie and I are celebrating our wedding anniversary this week. Totally excited about that. We're going to see Fiddler on the Roof, of course, at Stratford, a beautiful show about tradition, love, family, and turbulent times. Sort of pretty much sums up the marriage. And then, oh, come on, like you don't have turbulent times. Everyone has turbulent times. And that's, you know, for me, it's how we get through those turbulent times. That's one of the keys to succeeding in a marriage, I think. Getting through, we all have turbulent times. It's just how you get through them. You know, and the other things I mentioned in the show, you know, it's the tradition and the love, family, and faith. Of course, the show's about faith. All of those are the elements that really help us get through. So anyway, we're having our anniversary. That's exciting. And the other, to talk about turbulent times, the other big thing is 50. I've turned 50. I've been around for half a century. And, you know, it doesn't really bother me. People, oh, how do you feel? I think getting old is fun. It gives me this license to act, you know, like an old guy. In a jovial, I've always kind of been like this, sort of this jovial but cranky kind of guy. And when I was young, I was both skeptical and very playful. So there was this kind of duality. And, you know, as a young person, sort of people didn't know what to make of me. They were suspicious of me. But now it sort of just suits me because I'm 50. So the interview coming up, it's kind of a bit meandering. We kind of go all over the place in a sort of jazz kind of way and always sort of pull it back to theater. Kelly and I talk about a bunch of things. I hope you have a chance to listen to the whole thing. The role of critics in selling show tickets, as I mentioned, in the wake of social media. Lots to go on there. And even just old school. You know, Brendan Healy, the artistic director of Toronto's Buddies and Bad Times, recently reached out to the patrons of his theater, encouraging them to buy tickets to a show that got great reviews in the Toronto Star, but wasn't selling. You know, so there's a show that gets great reviews in the old days. The review sold tickets. Today, not so much. So that, you know, questions, of course, the role of the critic in selling tickets. The conversation goes beyond just show reviews, though, and we talk about Kelly's opinion pieces that he writes about the Canadian theater scene, which is really important to have that national perspective. And we talked about a column he wrote that helped inspire Hannah Moscovitch to write This Is War, the production that was performed in Toronto and Winnipeg and will soon be opening up in Chicago, so that's great. I do hope you enjoy the interview. Please be sure to leave a comment on the website, theinadequatelife.com. And by the way, I'm so excited because we're on iTunes, which is great. It makes it so easy to find. You can listen to us on your mobile phone now when you duck out for a walk, or if you're on the treadmill, wherever you have your phone, you can give us a listen just by iTunes. You know, I hate to admit this, but I listen to podcasts a fair amount, hopefully like you. And I got to listen to that podcast. Oh, I have to have a bath. Oh, I can do both at the same time. I don't think it's a good idea. So I've come close to getting into the bath with my mobile and the earbuds, and I always think better of it. But if you've had that experience, I'd love to hear about it. Does anyone trust themselves well enough to do that? I don't. Now, there you go. Please stay tuned. Listen to the interview with J. Kelly Nestor. So, we're up at Karen Hartwick's place in Stratford, and I woke up Kelly very early at around 2. Do this podcast, but you were filing your story. You were doing your job late last night at 3 a.m.
Yes, because of the internet now and some changing deadlines, I'm filing my Thursday night reviews that night, and so I don't have a hard deadline on that, which is the worst for me because I will just write as long as it takes me. I usually write right up to deadline. In this case, I believe I filed my Tommy review at about 3 a.m.
Yeah.
So then I slept in, yes. Yeah. And I had been up for a bit, but I hadn't actually gone out for breakfast yet.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for coming and sharing your breakfast time with us.
It's all right. I've got a yogurt and berries here from Tim Hortons.
Yeah, no, it looks good. And tea, this is some kind of, in your juice, you get the tea, which, you know, I don't know if you've seen the documentary about orange juice, but you're going to stop drinking that if you ever do. And then
that's why I don't watch documentaries.
Yeah, exactly. I haven't seen the documentary either, but I've heard about it. And I just, you know what, when I buy a bunch of oranges and juice them, it's just like nirvana. It's heaven. And then this is some kind of cold magnolia tea that Karen presented for us, which is actually really nice, refreshing.
It's lovely. It's always nice to come visit out here.
It's opening week at the Stratford Festival 2013. So far, the shows that have been out, and I haven't seen any of them in opening, is Romeo and Juliet, Measure for Measure, Fiddler on the Roof, Tommy. I'm excited. Now, you've seen them all. I'm excited. So Romeo and Juliet, I have tickets for, but my wife booked a surprise birthday party for me in Toronto, so it conflicts. So I'm going to miss miss Romeo and Juliet right now. Fiddler, we have tickets for on our anniversary because it's my wife's favorite show. So we're really excited about that. We got tickets right up close and totally excited about that. Measure for Measure, I'm just fascinated by Measure for Measure in the terms of the political corruptness and what's going on right now in Canada and Ontario, specifically, or Ottawa and Toronto. And then Tommy was last night that you saw. I saw that in a preview. And then what's tomorrow night? What do you get to see? Or tonight, rather.
Tonight is the much-anticipated production of Mary Stuart, directed by Anthony Cimolino, the new artistic director.
Yeah, so they open the week with a Shakespearean play, not directed by Des. Friday night, Anthony gets to do his thing after his huge success last year, Cymbeline. You know, your reviews are online. They're at globeandmail.com, or if you want to find them all, just go to stratfordfestivalreviews.com. But overall, what are your impressions? What do you look forward to? What are you excited about this season here at Stratford?
Well, there's a number of individual shows that I'm excited for. I'm very interested to see Mary Stuart tonight. I think it's the type of thing that Anthony will do quite well, and the cast is pretty extraordinary. With Shauna McKenna and Lucy Peacock playing the two main characters there. That would be Elizabeth I and Mary Queen of Scots. And it's a play I've only read. I've never seen it before, even though it's been done a number of times. I believe Soulpepper did it while I was living in England. And it was on Broadway not too long ago. Anyway, so I'm excited to see that play with that cast. I'm really looking forward to, of the Shakespeare's, I'm looking forward to Othello in August. It doesn't open until August. But Chris Abraham is directing it, and he's just a director that I really admire. He does all sorts of... I'm sort of more familiar with his work on new plays.
Yeah, his the two shows I've seen Chris direct here, and he's agreed to be on the podcast. We're just trying to figure out a date, so I'm so excited about that. Was The Little Years, which was, I guess, 2 years ago, which has got to be one of my favorite productions ever at Stratford. I was just blown away by that show.
Great.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that. And then last year was The Matchmaker.
Yeah, The Matchmaker last year was such a joyous production. I think that was when... Because, you know, I've seen Chris's work in sort of smaller Toronto theaters for a number of years. He runs a company called Crows in Toronto that will soon have its own space in Toronto's East End. But then to see him do something that's a bit of an old chestnut like The Matchmaker, I thought, well, is he really the right director for this? Is that the right stage for this play? You know, because they did it in the Festival Theater on the Thrust stage, and it's kind of a proscenium arch play. It's farce, so it's, you know, slamming doors doesn't really work on the Thrust stage. And yet somehow he found a way to make it really work in that space, I thought. And it was just, I was just one of the most wonderful moments of my theater going last year. Like, I just found it really joyous.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I remember coming out of it afterwards and thinking to myself, I haven't laughed that hard. Like, I don't remember when I've laughed that hard, not only in the theater, but at a film, you know, like, I just don't remember laughing that much out loud at anything. So as you say, joyous is a great word.
This is a fellow who I've talked about his love of Martin Crimp and that sort of that style of playwright, you know, sort of like dark British, you know, ambiguous dramas. And so to see him take on Thornton Wilder and just succeed so brilliantly, it boosted my respect for him, which was already pretty high.
Yeah, well, and I guess the pressure's on, because it kind of came out of nowhere last year. We weren't expecting that, so now he's got that poor guy.
Yes. Yes, with Othello. But Othello is a great play. I think it's the tragedy that works the best on stage.
Yeah.
It can really kill me. The last production I saw in London with Ewan McGregor, and I feel terrible because I never know how to pronounce his name, the fellow who played Othello. They call him Chewy.
Okay.
You know, the actor who was in Kinky Boots, the movie.
Oh, yeah.
Chiwetel.
Yeah.
Is his first name. Chiwetel Ejiofor.
Yeah, I know exactly who you're talking about.
Anyway, he was an extraordinary Othello. And that production was centered around Othello rather than Iago, as it sometimes can be. And I was just in tears for the last 10 minutes of it. So that's tough, too, because the last production, you know, when the last production of a play you saw just blew you away to come back to the play again.
Mm-hmm.
It's better to come into a show having seen a bad production of it before.
Right, right.
Because then your expectations are lower.
Or nothing. Did you say, is it Mary Stuart tonight that you said you've never seen?
Yeah, no, I've read it, but I've never seen it on stage. So, I mean, that's the kind of thing that, for me, coming up to Stratford, I always get excited about the shows that I've never seen and that I'm unlikely to see in other places across the country. So, Antony's production of Bartholomew Fair a few years back was a real highlight.
I remember
of
that.
My Stratford going for me.
Yeah.
I've talked about it a lot, actually.
Oh, really? You mean, so as you travel around and you're sort of extolling the virtues of some of the stuff that goes on here.
Yeah, I don't really need to see another production of Midsummer Night's Dream, but
right.
I'm excited to see A Measure for Measure.
All right, so let's go on. Let's move on to the mystique of being a critic. Because we kind of got into it a little bit there. You were just talking about, you know, the impact of seeing a bad show or a good show in terms of the next, you know, the review, the impact that might have on the review. And then how did you get into it? Like, what's your path? How in the world does anyone become a professional theater critic? In a world like in Canada, there's how many are there of you?
I mean, those of us who do it full time and are remunerated enough by it to live.
That's the key. That's what I'm talking, professional.
It's like a handful, you know, there's probably under 10.
But yeah, there's not many. So there you are, very fortunate. And it's a very important role. You know, part of, on the podcast I talk about is the impact of the arts in society and how we take it for granted. And I part of the reason I'm doing this is because I don't think that traditional media, certainly traditional broadcast media, covers the arts as much as it should in terms of how many people spend money on going to see the arts or are participating in the arts. If you really think about it, broadcast almost does nothing, you know, and on a regular, where's a regular place you can go in Canada to find out something about the performing arts? There's Q on CBC. There's not a lot.
Yeah, I mean, Q is such a great program. It's I wish that they did do more on theater, but they come to it pretty regularly, mm-hmm. which is great. And it's tough, of course, because theater is so city-specific.
Exactly, yeah.
It's hard
yeah.
to cover from a national perspective, yeah. which is the dilemma that I'm faced with writing for a national newspaper.
So how did you become a theater critic? Where'd you grow up?
I grew up between Montreal and Winnipeg.
Wow, those are two cities of that. I heard the Montreal thing, so that's interesting. Me too. I grew up in Montreal, lived in Winnipeg for several years.
Oh, yeah. My family is from Montreal. They're Montreal Anglophones.
Yeah.
And my parents moved to Winnipeg. They were part of the Anglo Exodus in the 70s. Then I was born out there in Winnipeg, and my parents divorced when I was about 6 months old. Not to get into much of a personal history, but what it meant is that what it means is that I spent the summers in Winnipeg growing up and the winters in Montreal.
Interesting.
My father is a musician. And his main source of income in the summer used to be, in any case, playing in the pit at Rainbow Stage.
Wow.
Which is an outdoor, semi-outdoor covered musical theater.
It's legendary. I mean, a lot of people in their path, a lot of young actors have taught, and on this show specifically, have talked about traveling through Rainbow Stage at one point in their career earlier. I'm not sure if it still even exists now, but back in the day, it was a place you went to work on your chops.
Yeah, it's still around. I mean, I saw Tom Allison in his first professional roles there. Hmm. Tom, who, of course, is now a Shaw Festival star for the last couple seasons, and he was one of the judges on the Over the Rainbow show where they picked Dorothy.
Right.
So, yeah, I grew up seeing all those shows and my dad playing the music at home, and certainly that's where I first fell in love with theater. It was great to be able to go to the show once or twice over the course of the summer, and then my father would bring me down, show me the pit, take me backstage, introduce me to the actors. There's a Winnipeg actor named Stan Lesk, who I'm not sure if he's still practicing out there, but I just loved him. I thought he was the funniest guy on the planet when he played roles like...
So how old are we talking here? Sorry, I interrupted you.
Just growing up, from a young age. I don't know what the first show was that I saw there, but that was definitely my introduction to theater.
Cool. But you had no desire to get on stage, or did you...
Well, so then I went at school in Montreal... I certainly performed through high school, and I had a great teacher named Doug Flowen, who directed two Shakespeare plays a year, one with the sort of junior grades and one with all the grades together. So that was great to be involved in that. And then there was a musical at the school every year too. So I did a lot of shows as an actor then. And then I went to McGill, where I studied theater. Theater there is studying it from an academic perspective.
Sure,
So it's like you study literature.
Yeah.
At the same time, however, there's a lot of practical courses.
So was it a BFA that you would have come up with? Or?
No, it was BA.
BA
in English in the theater stream. Plus, it was a joint degree with the history department as well.
Hmm, wow. That all makes sense now. I'm starting to understand more of your reviews. I totally get it now. That's good, though. I get it, yeah.
So I directed and acted and wrote some terrible little plays there.
In Montreal?
Yeah.
Did
a couple fringe festivals there.
The Fringe Festival in Montreal bugged me a little bit because, years ago, before there was a Fringe in Montreal, I was involved in the Fringe Festival. The first one we did was Edmonton. Gary Yates, my buddy, and I, we did a Fringe in Edmonton years ago. And then we traveled a writ in Canada. We were the first... first Canadians to do the Fringe in Hong Kong. And then when we came back, they announced the Montreal Fringe. And I remember at the time, they were going to have a quota system. They had a quota of English to French acts, which I thought, because I love the concept of the Fringe where it's a lottery, it's just anyone can get in. And all of a sudden, they're putting a quota system. So we wrote letters to the editors and complained about it. I don't know if they still have the quota, but it goes back to what you talked about, the thing that drove your parents away from Quebec, the never-ending politics. Anyway, so there you were, the Fringe Festival in Montreal, which is, I don't know if it's a pop, well, it is. I mean, that's where a couple of shows have come out of the Fringe. I always think of Rick Mercer, first of all.
Rick Miller.
Rick Miller. So
yeah, I saw Rick Miller doing his shows way back when. Some of them that weren't as successful as, say, McComber, which never dies.
Yeah.
Remember one called But Is It Art, where he did, it was The Simpsons doing
But Is It Art?
Was it Les Mis or something? I don't quite remember. But at the end, there were all these little, he did these like last sketch comedy back in the day too. And he had this character, this like nationalist French singer who sang English pop and rock tunes with French lyrics. I can't remember what it was called. You can find it on YouTube. That to me is the kind of humor that I grew up with. Right. All that sort of referendum era humor that just I still watch that video on YouTube and burst out laughing. My family,
it was politicized. We grew up in a political environment, you know,
for sure. Like the big no rally was such a huge moment for my friends and I growing up. Though I always remember it being a little bit, you know, not this huge outpouring support of like, oh, we love Canada. What I remember primarily is a friend of mine who was there. We got the day off school and we went there, and one of my friends ended up being sort of felt up by someone in the crowd. Oh, I've always wanted to include that in like a novel or something about that era in Montreal. And just, it was strange. You were forced to choose between being a Canadian or Quebecois. Yeah. And most of my friends were kind of ambivalent about it and just said, well, you know, we hate this division, the two nationalisms are sort of equally off-putting. So we just sort of were like, oh yeah, we're Montrealers. That's what we're Montrealers. Of course, I haven't lived in Montreal now for a decade, but that's still sort of an identity that I cling to.
Yeah, well, Montreal here we go. Two Montrealers saying how great Montreal is. But the funny thing is, it is. And it's always hard as a Montrealer. I don't know if it was for you, but growing up in Montreal, it was hard to finally say, hey, Toronto's actually pretty cool. Like, I remember, you know, Toronto was the devil. So I took a route different. I mean, not different than yours, but I was Toronto. No, what was I? Montreal and Ottawa, then Winnipeg, and then back to Montreal, and then Toronto. And then I was in Toronto for quite a while. And when I got there, I was like, wow, this is great. What's all this stuff about Toronto being a bunch of losers? It was a great place.
Yeah, I've lived in Toronto off and on for a decade now, and I do love it.
It's the longest place I lived as an adult, and but accepting the fact that a Montrealer is going to be able to enjoy Toronto. But the funny thing about the politics growing up in that political environment, not the funny thing, but the observation for now is that I was just talking to a Montrealer last night on the phone who lives in Winnipeg, and we were just laughing how finally Ontario politics is actually kind of interesting. It's just, there's corruption, there's murder. It's like Quebec, except we're in Ontario. It's fun.
Well, for me, the significance of growing up in Montreal in that environment is that culture, language, these things are so important. And the topic of debate and the topic of, well, are we going to have a country or be part of another country? What does that mean? So culture has always been one of the most important things in a society to me. So that, to me, was a little bit strange moving to Ontario, is that there's a lot of the sort of narrative around the arts is, oh, well, do the arts make us a world-class city? Oh, what are the economic spin-offs of having the arts? And it's less about, who are we?
Yeah, who am I?
Why are we living? What are we living for? What's this, you know, what's it all about? You know, that's less the discussion around the arts. So
that's interesting. Would you say that's true even amongst the artists?
It sort of depends. I feel like for a long time there was, you know, a lot of the discussions sort of turned to models, funding models, not enough funding, and why can't it be more like this? And, you know, the big debate over whether artistic directors should be, you know, how much control boards should have over artistic directors in the past year. Those sort of debates are interesting, but, you know, I just would like to talk about the art more. And I try to not do too many. I do write more features now, but I do try and bring it back to the art. You know, like, what are these? What are we doing? What's on the stages?
Mm-hmm. And how does it impact? Your background at McGill makes sense there, because your work tends to have has huge historical references. And you go, how did he know that? Now, how did you know that? It's like you go, okay, either he's on it. That's when I read your stuff. Just the other day, you made the reference to Martha Henry's production of Measure for Measure, and I'm thinking, where'd you get that?
Oh, you know, Wikipedia.
don't make it sound so easy.
No, that's a joke. I'm actually back at school right now, part-time.
Oh, cool.
Studying at the Center for Theater Drama and Performance Studies at
U of T.
At U of T. Yeah. Just sort of part-time. I started that a few years ago. Just to have more ideas come into my head. Because I just spit stuff out all the time. So it's nice to just sit and learn things and spend more time on something than 24 hours.
Interesting. I did an MA just a while ago in communication, so it was in a similar experience, part-time again. And I'd gone from the same thing. You've been practicing. So now you're studying again. And what do you, is that an MA? You're going to get an MA when you get out of that? Or
Yes, I'm going to get an MA. Very
don't
useful.
Sound like, say, you know, well, it is useful. You'll be
really
amazed.
Useful MA.
You'll be amazed.
In theater, drama, and performance studies.
But how? So when did you make that turn from going back to the McGill and then post McGill acting Fringe Festival? When did you realize you can get paid to write about theater?
Well,
were you Now magazine or anything like that? Not Now. What was it in? Was it in Montreal?
They used to be the Mirror and the Hour, which right, are yeah. both gone oh, now. In the past 2 years, yeah. These wonderful weeklies that sort of. You would read on yeah. the Metro and turn to the theater pages. I mean, the critic that I remember reading in the Hour was Gaetan Charlebois.
Yeah, I remember
who
that.
Now runs the Charlebois Post.
Ah, that makes sense. You know what? I've been looking at, I've just started cluing into him, and I didn't connect it because I've been, it's so long since I've been in Montreal reading the Hour and reading the Mirror, but that now I get it, Gaetan Charlebois. I don't know if he's getting a lot of traffic. I'm just starting to link to his reviews on StratfordFestivalReviews.com, so that's good.
Oh, great. Yeah, and I'm glad that they're sending people up here. I find his website really useful. The design is pretty awful, but it just really covers the country in a way that nothing else does, fairly comprehensively. It's very impressive what he does, and it's on a shoestring, sure. no-string budget.
Yeah.
But I remember him when he worked as a theater critic at The Hour, and he was always causing some sort of havoc. Like, there's some famous story of him standing up at the end of some show and yelling, "C'est de la merde!"
Oh,
and then getting
God.
Banned from a theater. He got banned from a couple theaters. Anyway.
That's good, though. That's the difference between, I guess, the Quebec. In Quebec, we'd celebrate that and champion that. In Ontario, it would be sort of something to be ashamed of, I guess. I don't know.
I don't know.
I hope not.
I only wanted to stand up and really boo a play a couple of times. But I feel like I have means of expression elsewhere.
Yeah, you gotta go under the radar now.
Yeah, but I do encourage other people to boo. I think people should bring booing back.
Well, so I want to keep going back to the, when did you realize you could make money writing?
Okay, so I was studying at McGill, and then I had a whole succession of awful jobs.
Oh, good. We love that on the show.
Over the course of my summers, that sort of thing, like working at Second Cup or... I was a telemarketer for a little while.
Yeah,
these are while you're in university jobs.
What were you
jobs.
Selling on the phone?
Actually, it was a total scam. It was something we called people up, told them that they won some sort of draw, some lottery draw, and that now they were eligible for this $10,000 prize. And as the first part of their prize, they could purchase this package that included a subscription to U.S. News and World Report and some camera for the low price of $600 or something like that. It was just a complete and utter scam.
Sure, yeah. Well, there's a lot of that in Montreal. There is.
Yeah, well, it's hard to find jobs as an Anglophone
yeah.
when you're going through school. That place ended up being busted by the police shortly after I resigned.
Well,
anyway.
It makes me think of Jonathan Goldstein. Do you ever listen to Jonathan Goldstein's?
Yeah.
See, that makes me think of, because he did that for a while. And it makes me think of the rock and roll thing, because that guy ends up going to a call, the documentary about the rock and roll, Anvil. Did you ever see Anvil, the film? He ends up going to he ends up in one of those call centers and just, he can't do it. He's like, I can't do this. I can't lie to people.
Well, I could lie to people. I was very good at it.
Uh-oh. That's the theater in you.
But then I remember I kept a note of all the dead people that I would call who had apparently entered this lottery. And that was sort of my first inkling that what I had was doing was just totally false. And I decided when I got to 50 dead people, I would quit.
Wow.
When I did, I stood up in the middle of the afternoon and quit. And then they were busted by the police like a couple weeks later. They didn't arrest the kids who were working there, but it was run by the Jewish mafia in I guess I shouldn't say anything more about that, actually.
Okay.
Anyway, it was an interesting job.
There's a lot of mafias in Montreal.
There's all sorts
of
different
mafia
mafias.
It was a big deal on Crescent Street back in my day.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I remember having a run-in with the Dorval Mafia at one point. Anyway.
Those would be the guys working at the airport, because that's what Dorval is. Wow. So you got it. Now you're realizing, okay, I got to do something real.
Yeah, well, what I realized was I started to freelance a little bit. And at the time, though, even now, you know, I was getting paid more for an article than, you know, a week working minimum wage.
Right.
So I thought, oh, well, you know, even if I get rejected or only write X number of articles, this is an easier way to pay my way in a city that at the time I was paying, you know, $230 a month for rent.
Yeah,
so
Montreal's great for that.
I actually wrote my first article or two for the Globe and Mail when I was in undergrad. I wrote about a production of Henry V that Gareth Potter, who is now a Stratford star, was in. Huh. Or he, you know, you think he's in the Stratford company again this year.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was this bilingual production where Henry was sort of also Trudeau and the FLQ were the French. Anyway, it was interesting. So, yeah, after that, after university, I intended to go into journalism.
Yeah.
And I did. I interned at the National Post, where I wrote about news for about 3 months. I wasn't that great as a news reporter.
Yeah, I hear you. I'm not, yeah.
And then a position opened up in the arts department that fall after my summer internship. And they had people who were, you know, they had people who covered music, who covered film.
Oh, yeah.
They have a theater critic there, who's Robert Cushman, who's still there. But they didn't have any reporters on staff who were remotely interested in the performing arts. So this thing that I'd studied that I thought was fairly useless ended up being the thing that helped me get a permanent job. So it was very lucky. I ended up being performing arts reporter at the Post pretty much right out of school, and then I worked there for 3.5 years.
That is great. Yeah. I don't think luck has a lot to do with it, because, and it's something I tell my students too, well, I love, number one, I love that while you were studying, you were actually doing work that you could then get published. Like, that's a brilliant thing to do, right? You're working, and I my journalism students, I try to sort of seed, I mean, I don't, you got to be careful because you don't want to spoon feed them, but I try to seed ideas and say, here's something that's going on in the world right now that might, you might be able to exploit it and actually get a story published somewhere and make some money. You try as much as you can. So I think it's great that you were able to do that during school. It sets a good example for young people who are interested. And I always tell people, you know, when you're young, whatever you're doing now and you're good at, it's probably going to end up being what you're going to do later on. You know, like, follow what you love, get good at it. If you're in school, you know, study and work hard. And even when I did my MA, I remember one of my colleagues, he's like, you know, the papers that you're writing for your MA, make them publishable in the academic press. So I really strove to do that and had some success doing that, although that's a whole different world. But I think that's great. So school actually helped you get a job. How about that?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you stuck to your guns. You didn't try to become something you weren't. You actually had an interest in a very after studying at McGill, thorough knowledge of the arts and the performing arts. And when there was a job around, you were the guy.
Yeah, those first years at the Post were really, I was just amazed that all these people who I had studied, I was able to go and talk to and interview, you know, like Judith Thompson or Morris Panitch. I remember the first time that I got to interview Morris Panitch, I was thrilled.
Huh.
Daniel McIver, I had directed Never Swim Alone in undergrad, and I still admire him so much that to be able to meet him and talk with him and write about him was such a treat.
So now you mentioned Morris, you want to talk about social media?
Well, let's just finish the career path, because it's two more steps. 3.5 years at the Post, I moved to England, worked at The Guardian there.
That's a great place to be. What were you thinking? Why'd you leave?
I had my Irish citizenship from my grandmother, who was born in Ireland. My whole family suddenly realized that we could get Irish citizenship through her.
That's funny.
So I thought, all right, well, I could use an Irish passport. I used it. I used it to go straight to London, of course, as most Irish people would do.
That's great. Yeah.
So I went to London. I freelanced there for a bit. Went through my meager savings at the time.
Yeah.
Because I was London's, not making enough well, to live in
London's
London.
London's expensive.
And then I applied for jobs at The Guardian because I love, it's one of the best newspapers for arts coverage in the world. And I worked as a sub-editor on their arts website. So sub-editor means, you know, like copy editor, essentially. Yeah. But I got to write for them as much as I wanted as well. And I was continuing to freelance for Canadian papers. And when Kamel, my predecessor, left to go work at Ryerson, they had an opening for a theater critic at the Globe. And I had a relationship with the editor. And he brought me in for an interview. And I was hired as their new theater critic.
Yeah.
And I moved back to Canada in 2008.
Wow. Okay. Why did you leave? Oh, you left because of the Irish passport. One of my students at Western, a journalism student, did her internship in Ireland. I don't know if she's in Belfast or whatever. And she comes back. They all go for 6 weeks, and she comes back. And I was really excited. And I'm like, I said, so how was Ireland? How'd you like it? And she goes, this is literally what she said. She goes, I don't know. I couldn't eat any of the food that they eat, and I really couldn't understand the language. That's what she said.
Okay.
Which I thought was just great. I haven't been, but she just painted this really bizarre picture. She just felt like, she was, I don't know what she was expecting, but it wasn't what she got. But she had a great time. But the line about the food and the language just made me laugh so hard. Anyway, so there you go. So you've been there, and a lot is since 2008. There was really, was there even a comment section on the when you first got there? Just going to the social media thing.
You know,
at the Globe and Mail, could people comment? Because now, so we're talking about social media and how it's changed. We're going to get there. I think it's changed fundamentally the relationship between the critic, the audience, and the artist. Like that triangle is totally
definitely
changed.
Definitely. I mean, the Globe and Mail is a paper that traditionally has been the newspaper of record. Its voice is the voice of God in some sort of way in many different, including its editorials and that sort of thing. It sort of has this we are the wise people pronouncing sort of feel sure. to it traditionally. So that's not really how I view the role of a critic, and I talked about that from my interviews, and I think that's probably why they were interested in me, is that I was at the time really interested in particularly blogging at the time.
Yeah. So the role between the artist and the critic, so we'll talk about Morris just to get that out of the way. On last year, this is, I'm going to read this thing because it came out, this was what how he responded. You wrote a review of it was out at Stratford. What was the show? It was
the show was called Wanderlust.
Wanderlust.
It was Morris Panych's musical with Merrick Norman about
Robert Service.
Was it Robert Service?
Yeah. So and I'm not going to read your review, but it was. I just read it before I came out to talk to you. It was so. I love the adjective serviceable because that's my wife's favorite adjective. If we go to a restaurant. Anyway, serviceable. She loves that. She introduced me to that word.
I mean, it was just a pun. It was just a cheap pun. It was a musical about service, and I thought it was serviceable.
But I didn't even get the pun when I was rereading it. But it's a good. I think it's a great word, a great adjective. And then and sure-footed. You said his direction was sure-footed, and then you closed with a line from The Clash. Gotta love that. Should I stay or should I go? So I think you know. Anyway, I read the review. The full review's on the site, and then Panych responded on the Globe and Mail site, and I'm just going to read a bit of it. He basically got a little sarcastic. Wow, Kelly, spot on. How could, and so he's talking about some of the things you were critical of. How could we not have seen it? I ask myself how, he writes, 3 years and no one, not one person, dramaturge, producer, actor, musician, designer, builder, seamstress, backstage crew, not even our stage manager, could so clearly see what you ascertained in one single sitting. Was it your special opening night pants? Anyway, it goes on, and it's sort of, you just, as a reader, you don't know, is he joking? Or, you know, you just kind of go, what the heck's going on? And then all of a sudden, that image of you, did you put up that, or did he put up that? The animated image of you with the shorts on?
Yeah, I had worn shorts that opening. And, I believe
hot.
That's his partner, Ken McDonald.
But you kind of embraced that image,
designer.
Did you not?
Yeah. Well, I mean, he drew this great picture of me just like with this empty thought bubble above my head sitting while all around me stand.
So funny.
In
all right,
because
you sat down. You didn't stand up for the standing ovation.
I don't know if I did or didn't because I tend to just stand when other people stand.
Sure.
I don't really feel like it means anything.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I was sitting purposefully or
whatever.
Not, but I am in this picture,
yeah,
which is
sitting
a great little cartoon.
It is a good cartoon. And I think it's admirable of you that it was my impression that you embraced that image and you didn't, you know, the whole thing is, you know, so many years ago when I came to London, people, and another thing you do in social media is you refer to other critics in Twitter and you'll actually tweet about what the other critics are saying. Am I wrong about that? No, you do that.
No, I do.
I love that.
I wish someone, because I love what you do here at the Stratford Festival, aggregating all the reviews of all the critics, yeah, including the bloggers, not just the print critic. That's great.
We, as you said, when you're talking about the Globe and Mail, all these organizations thought they were the voice of record and there was no one else and the other ones didn't matter. I mean, there was a period, obviously, a long time ago when you would get columnists and people talking about each other, but when you pushed it into the arts, did you get any pushback from the Globe or was it, has anyone ever commented on it?
To be honest, I sort of work in the margins there, so I didn't.
That's great, though.
I haven't really got a lot of pushback.
Yeah.
I seem to remember once writing something about the Toronto Star, and then it being being an issue or being discussed with me back in the early days. And it was based on this idea that you don't discuss other news media. But I mean, the Globe has changed so much since I've been there. As you know, we have a public editor now, which is a totally new idea for the Globe.
An alumnus of a program at Western. I have to get that in there. Sylvia Stead.
There you go. So there's more discussion about what's going on in the newsroom, how it's being created, and trying to build those relationships with
Communities out there.
Communities and readers. I mean, it's totally... Look at the Rob Ford story. You see how much it's changed. Like, everyone is... We're now writing... A Toronto newspaper claimed this, that they saw this video now.
That's right.
Toronto Star reporters did this, right? Yeah. Gawker said this. You know, subsequently, other papers saying the Globe and Mail reported this.
Right.
You know, to me, there's no point in sort of covertly talking about something when there's Google, because you're just going to send your readers to Google.
Yeah. No, I agree 100%. Yeah.
Like, why would you say something that confuses people or that then sends them to the internet to find out the answers?
Yeah. Well, that's good. Well, hopefully everyone else will come along.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've written about Richard Dezunian from time to time because he actually actively works as a theater professional. I've gone up and reviewed shows of his in Barrie. And I interviewed Robert Cushman for the Globe. That I thought was strange that they let me do that. But
what was the context? I love Robert's writing. What was the context for that? I didn't read that.
So do I, and it's a shame he's down to once a week there. But we were working on a fundraiser. You're a good man, Charlie Brown.
That's right.
Theater Critics performed in it. We raised money for the Actors Fund. It was a follow-up to something we had done a few years before. So I just thought it'd be fun to interview Robert Cushman because he was being directed by his son, Mitchell Cushman. Hmm. You know, there's all these things that go on. Like, oh, well, Mitchell Cushman's the son of Robert Cushman, etc. And then we're just supposed to, like, not talk about it.
Sure.
I figure it's better to talk about it.
And Richard Dezunian, as a director, has an interest in, I don't want to say building a star system, but supporting actors that he favors that he may one day want to put into his own show. I'm just saying. I don't know if that's true or not. But.
Well, I mean, that's interesting. Like, the thing about Richard is that I really admire his writing and I admire his long career in the theater that he had before and his sort of commitment to continuing on with the arts because that's something that he really loves and I think that shows in his writing. But again, I think he's a little too old school would be my only complaint about it is not that he does all these things, but that he's not more open about it. That he doesn't discuss it. That he doesn't write about it.
That's fascinating.
That he doesn't say in his reviews, you know, when he's reviewing someone who
he might be working with.
He might be working with or might have just been working with.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's interesting. I think that makes him a more interesting critic, not a less interesting critic.
Yeah, no, you're right. But that, again, that's the old school, new school thing. And it's a risk. It means you're taking a risk, you know. You can actually open yourself up a little bit more.
I mean, I'd love to see him on Twitter as well. I think he'd be a very entertaining Twitterer, but he says he'll never do it.
Well, for a while he was doing, I can't believe we're talking about Richard Dezunian, but for a while he was doing a post, this is like 3 years ago, he did a post-show review on Stratford on YouTube. So after the show was over, kind of like your quick hits last year, he'd come off the show and then do like a minute and a half on YouTube, just him in front of his computer, put them up on YouTube. They're not doing them anymore. I don't know.
Well, you know, he didn't have the right equipment for it. There's a lot of experimentation going on, and the quick reviews that I was doing was an experiment.
So this brings up the question about, you know, the 24-hour news cycle that changed broadcast news in the news world. And now it's having an impact on theater because by the time your pieces come up at theglobeandmail.com, there's already a bunch of dialogue on Twitter. There's already a bunch. It's not your dialogue and it's not the informed dialogue that you bring having studied everything you studied, but there's still something out there. Do you think that's going to, how is that impacting your writing or has it impacted your writing?
I don't know. It's interesting because one of the things I mentioned is that I'm writing more features lately, which means sort of interacting with the theater community on a different basis. So, for instance, I had interviewed Tim Carroll about original practices before I went to review his show, his production of Romeo and Juliet, which drew on some of his original practices work.
So you think that spending that time with him before the interview had an impact on your perception?
No doubt. And for me, the problem is that I really like Tim. I like
the problem. That's a problem. Why is that a problem?
I wasn't in love with the production.
Sure.
And I don't really.
So that then does that make it harder for you to write then? Or
yeah, get any enjoyment from writing negative reviews. You know.
Yeah.
I think some people maybe do, but for me, it all, you know, unless I feel that there's, I don't enjoy writing negative reviews when I feel that it was an honorable attempt. You know, right. that there was something interesting being attempted and it failed. The only time I actually enjoy writing a negative review is when I feel that there's some sort of that it's not a well-intentioned project.
Yeah, they're wasting project, our time.
Or, you know, it's a vanity project or that sort of thing. Yeah. Like, then I feel you can really call those people out.
Yeah, save it for that particular moment. So talking about your relationship with if you have a relationship with the artist, whether it's a director or a playwright or the actors, in advance, so obviously that has an impact on your ability to write. Hmm. And do you think, I was talking to another...
Well, I think it informs it. You know, again, for me, it's if you people access what I do in different ways. If you're a print subscriber, you may have read that review, not even realize that it was me interviewing it, because it's sort of a Q&A.
Yeah.
And then you might have read the review and not made that connection whatsoever. If you follow me on Twitter, you probably knew that I was coming up here to interview Tim Carroll.
That's true.
Read me tweeting about the
process,
review, and then... you know, saw me tweeting about that and also other people's reviews of that show. So it's more of a conversation and then it almost feels more organic.
Yeah. You know?
You
become different things to different people based on their consumption of what you're putting out.
Because
you're right, not everyone's reading, following you on Twitter. So, but thoughtful criticism can have an impact on future creative choices and decisions by an artist. I spoke to another friend of mine who's a writer. And he said, this is his line, because I asked him, I said, have you ever responded to a criticism, not like Morris did, which was sort of vitriolic writing, but actually using it to have an impact on your creative process? And my buddy said, I'd hate to be the person that admits this, but yes, a thoughtful, insightful piece that resonates can really impact the choices of my future work, which I thought was interesting, a confession that this guy made.
Hmm. Well, I have mixed feelings about that, because I think that artists should not really listen to critics, because, well, you know, we're individuals giving a take, and sometimes we're right and sometimes we're wrong, and you don't, you know, you have to listen to yourself and your collaborators primarily. That said, it's great when you can sort of have an impact in some other way than, I don't know, I think you can nudge people in interesting directions or sort of encourage certain types of work at certain types of theater companies. I know that once I wrote a column about the fact that I found it strange that no one in Canada was writing any plays about the conflict in Afghanistan that we were involved in for a decade, whereas I saw tons of American and particularly British plays that struggled with the Iraq War and also Afghanistan, and that just wasn't happening in Canada. And Hannah Moscovich read that column and then took me up on the challenge, included a reference to it in her pitch to... I guess Banff or wherever where she was applying for a residency. And then she wrote a great play called This Is War.
Right. Was it Edmonton or Winnipeg that opened? Or
well, it was at Tarragon in Prairie Theatre Exchange in Winnipeg this year. And next fall it opens in Chicago.
Wow.
And we just awarded it Best Canadian Play of the Year, the Toronto Theatre Critics Awards, which is something that I was instrumental in helping get set up 3 years ago, because I like the idea of critics talking to each other.
Do you feel any pressure to support theater as a whole? Do you feel like if I come in, you know, you show up in a town like Stratford and say you pan five shows, do you think that has an impact on ticket sales, or do you sort of have to do any reckoning with that?
That's interesting, because I don't know to what extent we have an impact directly on ticket sales.
Well, they're using your quotes all over the ads. I would assume that they believe that you do.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's less direct a link than it used to be. I don't know, you know, this is all anecdotal, but I hear that it used to be, you know, a rave review in the Star or the Globe would sort of help sell out a run in a sort of small house in Toronto, like something at the Tarragon on the main stage would sell out if it got, you know, a 4-star review. And then this is just anecdotal from a previous publicity director there, but he said that if he gets 2 4-star reviews, then it'll sell out now. And then you see shows that get really good reviews now. I remember this was the thing, right? It was Daniel McIver's recent show at Buddy's got 4 stars in the Toronto Star. And then, you know, the next week, Brendan Healy, the artistic director, is writing an email to the patrons of his theater saying, well, how come we're not selling out our house since we got this rave review?
Yeah.
And I think that maybe because people are reading sort of the entirety of the reviews now. I also think word of mouth has always been really important, and that's the best way of selling tickets. And that you can be sort of the person who influences certain people who go to the theater, but then they influence their circles.
Yeah, the early adopters. But you're kind of hedging the thing. So you're kind of hedging the question in terms of your own importance in selling tickets and then the relationship you have with the theatrical companies.
I can't think about it in terms of selling tickets.
But what happens if you ever think, I've given this company 5 or 3 bad reviews in a row. God, am I? Because they're probably thinking that. They're thinking, the bastard, I can't believe he dissed another show. What are we going to do? Or maybe they're not. I would assume, I'd be thinking, if I was a producer, I'd be thinking that.
Well, I don't know. That's not really my perspective. I would think, boy, this theater company's done 5 bad shows in a row.
They
need to get their act together.
Right.
You know, it's very rare that I'm a complete outlier with audience opinion or with critical opinion, you know?
Yeah.
Like, we tend to... They're having a lot of divisive shows in Toronto lately, but I don't know. For instance, I do read the other reviews. Everyone sort of felt roughly the same about Romeo and Juliet that I read so far.
Yeah. And what do you think your role is as a critic when you've got a company? And then we're not alone. You just talked about Michael Healy's, request to get people more engaged, and Stratford's down, a third, from 600,000 tickets a few years ago to 450. Well, how do you think you fit into that? And we all agree theater is important. We're all passionate about theater. That's why we're here. So how do you see the critic's role in trying to bring theater back and get people out to the shows?
Well, I think just having that space to discuss the art form is important to keep it as something that people would discuss. And then as for getting bums in seats, there's so many factors that have nothing to do with reviews. The story of what's gone on at Stratford over the past decade is either a story, is it really about declining standards or something? I don't think so. I think there's a whole bunch of reasons why fewer people are coming here, and whether it's, border restrictions or
the dollar,
or just the ongoing repercussions of the recession, or for that matter, just the fact that, the younger generation, just taking the teaching of theater out of schools, under the Mike Harris years, that has a long-term impact on the festival. And that's what happened at the Shaw Festival. People don't teach Shaw anymore, so.
Right, there's no connection
to the
work.
No one's really interested in they're not popular plays like they used to be. People don't have thoughts on them and want to see them on stage.
Hmm.
Same way they still do with Shakespeare.
Shakespeare, right. There's a sort of, that obligation.
To me, these festivals were built around the car culture of the 50s.
Hmm.
People thinking that it would be a lovely idea to get in their car
and
on a Friday
and
drive 2 hours to see a show. Now people get to the end of the week and think, God, the last thing I want to do is get on the highway and get stuck in that traffic.
The great point, last year rode your bike. Was it last year to the Shaw Festival?
Yeah, a couple years ago I rode my bike to the Shaw Festival. The Shaw Festival is awful in terms of getting there.
I thought it was better than Stratford, though, no? From Toronto?
Not really,
Okay.
The QEW is monstrous.
Yeah.
I leave early to get there.
How long did the bike ride take?
It took me the day.
The day? That's amazing. Did you go by yourself?
Once, yeah. I went with a friend another time. It's not the best bike ride. Parts of it are really nice. But there's a long stretch just right next to the QEW.
Yeah, that's the commitment. I love that. That's the commitment to theater.
Well, look, if you want to
bike... Any experience.
If you want to bike to the Shaw Festival, take one of the trains that goes to Niagara Falls and then that you can bring your bike on and then bike there. That's a nice bike ride.
That would be beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, so just to go back to the theater and bums and seats thing, because there's people who listen that are running community theaters.
Oh, just in terms of that, the bus that Stratford has just created between Toronto and Stratford, to me, will probably do much more for attendance than any reviews. Just having a bus that comes straight here.
Was it you that tweeted Don McKellar was on the bus?
Don McKellar was on the bus the other day.
What? That's such a... I just find that fascinating.
Don McKellar would not have come to the Stratford Festival if it was not for the new bus. I don't think that's true, but...
Yeah, I just find the funny that was a tweet unto itself. I thought was kind of a bizarre thing. Anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a question of, I think, one of the big challenges, and I've written about it a little bit and talk about it on the blog, is how theaters can leverage social media to try and get bums in seats, regardless of reviews, whether or not there's... Even if there's a bad review, well, let's post a bad review. That's the other thing that theater companies are still trying to hide from bad reviews. And you can't do that anymore. You can't hide. So you might as well acknowledge the fact that the bad review is out there and encourage people, as you say, to get into a conversation about it and go see the show and then talk about it. That's my take on it, but that's maybe a bit progressive still.
Well, there's, I mean, it's sort of like the perception out there from people who talk to me anyway is that, oh, Moore's Panic shouldn't leave these comments on my bad reviews of his shows. You know, what's he doing? He's just causing attracting attention to the bad review and doing something that you're not supposed to do as a theater artist. I don't understand that point of view. I think, well, great, he's coming out there. He's saying this show that I've done is worthwhile.
And you didn't recognize it, Mr. Critic.
Yeah, you didn't recognize it because you were wearing shorts.
Right.
or whatever it was last year. Incidentally, Robert Crewe from The Star was also wearing shorts that night behind me, and he gave it a worse review.
Oh, that's okay.
Some guy from Bloomberg, I think, just called it straight out dismal.
Right.
He didn't get any comments. So I'm flattered that I have put myself out there in such a way that people feel comfortable or feel that they can leave comments. Because that's what hopefully we're doing, is sort of moving towards more of a discussion.
Yeah, well, that's good. And hopefully people leave comments on the blog here about the podcast, and they can chime in as well. Anything else you want to add to this bizarre conversation, free-flowing?
Oh, yeah, it's pretty free-flowing. I don't know.
Where are you going to be in 10 years?
Where am I going to be in 10 years? Gosh, who knows where the newspaper industry will be in 10 years? It's, you know, it sometimes feels like we're getting our footing again. Sometimes it feels like Armageddon is on the way. And I hope, you know, to keep working, doing what I'm doing for a while, because I like following the story of Canadian theater. I find it really compelling.
Yeah.
I think there's so many great artists.
Well, I think at the Globe you're in a good place. Like I love the new style of the sheet. You know, is it tabloid the right word for the reduced size? There was so much of a fuss about that with the glossy paper. You know, the smaller.
Yeah. What is? Are we? We're not quite Berliner, but we're.
I don't know.
Something like that.
But I think it's great. I love that, and I love the. I love the fact that you're spending, the Globe is doing more video now. Actually, one of my former students is working at the Globe, and she's doing some more audio stuff. So I think if there's anywhere to be, you're in the right place in terms of, you know, adapting to the changes that are happening.
I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the Globe and Mail looks better now than it ever has in its history. It has more readers now than it ever has in its history because of its reach online.
Yeah.
The only thing is that the business model is a little uncertain. So it is writing, being a journalist right now, being a theater critic right now, it really is the best of times, the worst of times.
Yeah. Well, that's and you're right in the thick of it, and not afraid to sort of to embrace it and put up with Morris Panich commenting on your shorts.
It's great. I love that.
Yeah. All right. Well, Kelly, thanks. What's the J stand for?
The J, I don't know. I feel like it should be mysterious.
Oh, you can do that. That's fine.
It's just James.
Okay.
My parents named me James legally, but called me Kelly. So I always I started sticking the J in there when I was a teenager, because otherwise it didn't match up with my ID.
Oh, I gotcha. All right. Yeah. Well, J. Kelly Nestruck, thank you very much for coming and taking the time. I really appreciate it. I hope you enjoy Othello. And we'll hopefully get Chris Abram on and talk about that once he's sort of comfortable and all sort of relaxed. He's moved up to Stratford for the summer, I think. So.
Oh, yeah. You're great. He's a smart fellow, so I'm sure you'll have a good time with him.
Cool. Well, thanks very much. Bye now.
Cheers. Bye.
There you go. Theater critic, journalist, J. Kelly Nestruck. Lots of fun. I really enjoyed that conversation. So thanks to him for doing that during a super busy opening week. And you know, it was fun for me as a former Montrealer to share that conversation about growing up in a politically charged environment where arts and culture and language, you know, Bill 101, I was part of that kid going through that, where those things had an impact on the kind of theater that was produced around us. And sometimes when you're away from that in the rest of Canada, you feel a bit like a displaced person, or at least I do. Next Monday is my birthday, so I'm not sure who we're going to interview yet, but I will get someone, so come back for that. In the next couple of weeks, stay tuned for Shalina Kennedy. You'll remember her from West Side Story and Jesus Christ Superstar. She's coming up in a couple of weeks. So use iTunes, or if you're an Android person, I use Beyond Pod on my Android to subscribe to The Inadequate Life. Beyond Pod is an app. You can subscribe with that. And if you subscribe with one of these podcatchers like iTunes or Stitcher or Beyond Pod, the app that I like, you'll never miss an episode. So do that, and you can just listen whenever you want, even in the bath. One of the reasons I started this podcast is to remind everybody, myself included, that we all go through ups and downs in pursuit of creative inspiration. And part of that creative process, and it came up during the interview, is taking risks. Inevitably, risks lead to failure. and you know, the desire and the drive to start all over again. So don't let those tough times get you down, and be sure to listen to the good people you've surrounded yourself with. And most importantly, do good work yourself. Come back every Monday for another episode of Inadequate Life.